Church, I did find it a little interesting this morning on my way driving in. I told you a couple weeks ago the things that moms want. Driving in, there's several big trucks pulling boats, and I thought, oh, lots of moms want to go out in the boats. And I pulled up next to the car, and it was all dudes, and I thought, mom said, go out in the boat so that we can have peace and quiet. And so, moms, my prayer for you today is that you would have some peace and quiet, and everybody would go out in the boat for a little bit. If you have your Bibles with you this morning, I hope you do. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 21. If you're new, we're in a Netflix miniseries, season 2 of the Gospel According to Genesis. We've been looking at this dude by the name of Abraham, and our hope has been that this series has meant as much to you as it's meant to us, as we've had to wrestle with what it means to wait. Have we wrestled with what it means to live life in the messiness of this thing called life with God? As we look into the mirror and are honest about who we see, and as we remember that our God is faithful and that he's good and that he's merciful, and while I might beat myself up, and I might be asking myself over and over again, why am I doing that again? We still have a God who grabs my hand and walks me through it all. And for Abraham and Sarah, this waiting, this faith in a promise given, has been difficult. It's a very long journey for them. Abraham, if you think about this, Abraham and Sarah got married and they tried to have kids. Year after year, decade after decade, they tried to have kids. And eventually they realize it's not going to happen for us. And so they resign themselves to the fact that they were not going to have children. And they wrestled in that pain, and they wrestled in that hurt, and they wrestled in that difficulty. And they probably prayed, God, would you heal that wound? And they did this in a culture that values children above all things. In a culture that says if you're barren, you're cursed. You're cursed by the gods. And so now all of a sudden, God shows up. And he changes everything. He changes their location. He changes their perspective. He changes their understanding. And what he begins to do is he begins to pick at an old wound. He says, listen, I'm going to promise you land, seed, and blessing. All of these things, though, hinging on an heir, hinging on a child. And that hope of a child that they had put to bed years ago now, God has brought back to the surface and said, you will have a son. And 5 years pass, 10, 15, 20, 25 years pass, and no child. And they're like, land, why give us land, God? What good is land if we have no descendants to dwell on it? Blessing, why give us a blessing when the blessing would die with us? Why call it a blessing if there's no child in the equation? Why pick open the healed wound and tell us that our offspring is going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky, that our offspring is going to be like dust that cover the earth? God, why tell us that if you're not going to do what you say? But the incredible and yet sometimes frustrating thing about God is his promise is sure, but he's going to do it in his timing, because his timing and my timing are rarely the same. No amens. Come on, y'all are killing me, right? Because it's true, my timing and his timing are rarely the same. And so when my son was early in his elementary school years, my wife and I made a decision to walk with our son through various rites of passage towards being a man. What does it look like for him to live into manhood, into biblical manhood? And so we began to raise a modern day knight. And one of the markers that we would do is we would work on several biblical characteristics in him, and the rite of passage would be one of the stages of knighthood. And so one of them might be a squire. You've probably heard that. And so at each one, he would acquire a piece of something that goes with being a knight. So the first thing he would receive would be a kendril. A kendril is like a small dagger. And then after that, he would receive a shield. And then after that, he would receive a full-size sword as he moved through these various stages of knighthood. And as you can imagine, when a 9-year-old boy hears that a full-size sword is coming his way, is in his future, his next question is, when? When? And our answer was, not yet. Our answer still is, be patient. That some things need to happen to you. And some things need to happen in you before you receive this thing that I have for you. And he has received his kendril, and he has received his shield at each rite of ceremony passage we did with him. But the sword is yet to come. He's been waiting 18 years at this point for that sword. This final rite of passage has yet to arrive. And I'm sure that he thinks this very day, it's never gonna happen. I bet he thinks my dad is not very old, by the way. He's old and he's probably forgotten. And we have not. I have not forgotten. There is something that needs to happen first. And this promise that we talk about with Abram, it's been 25 plus years in the making. And the question that we continue to ask is, will God keep that promise? Is God gonna show up and deliver on a promise that he made a quarter century ago? But God is doing something both in him and in God's greater story that's being written. And so take a look at Genesis chapter 21, verse 1. This is what it says. Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah as he had said. And the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant, bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the very time God had promised him. Church, God is seldom early, but he is never late. He feels late all the time, doesn't he? Feels like he's always late. Our God is never late. Abraham's 100, Sarah's 90. And she gives birth for the first time to a son. This reminds me of 2 Peter 3, where Peter writes, but do not forget this one thing, dear friends, with the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years. And 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is patient with you. Which is interesting that he says he's patient with me. And I'm worried about him being on time. It took 25 years, but God delivered on this life-changing, miraculous promise he made to this couple so many years ago, and it happened at just the right time. Verse 3, it says, Abraham gave the name Isaac. That name means he laughs, by the way. Isaac means he laughs. Abraham gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him. When his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him as God commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, yet I have borne him a son in his old age. The child grew. It was weaned, and on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. So all these people get together to share a meal. Friends, family, all these people, coworkers, show up, and they're just laughing. But the people that are laughing, they're not laughing at them, but with them, saying, only God could do this. Guys, you are so old. You're not old. You are very old, according to scripture. And only God could do this. You have been barren for so long. This is so impossible. But God has showed up in your life, and that's fantastic. And they all laughed, and they all ate, and they all celebrated. How great is that moment? But the story is going to show us that not everything is hunky-dory on the home front. Look at verse 9. But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham was mocking, specifically mocking Isaac here. And that word mocking actually comes from Isaac's name. So he's not just laughing with them. He's more than just laughing at them. He is laughing maliciously. He is laughing with bitterness and cunning behind it. And at this point, Ishmael is probably about 14 years old. Does that sound about right for a 14-year-old? Because 14-year-olds are the same then, now, and forevermore. You know, we love them. You know, that's great. That's what's one of my favorite ages as I've worked in student ministries. That's probably one of the areas I love the most. But that's kind of par for the course. And he's mocking this chosen son of the promise. But in verse 10, Sarah's going to make a surprising demand. Verse 10, and she said to Abraham, get rid of that slave woman and her son. For that woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. She basically looks at Abraham and says, get him out of here. Get him out of here right now. Get them out of here. And it sounds incredibly harsh because if you remember the story last time this all went down, they tried to kick Hagar out. They tried to kick Ishmael out. God's like, oh, no, you don't. No, that's not what's going to happen. You're going to take care of her, and you're going to take care of your son. You just don't get to kick him out when life gets tough, because this is something that you did when you listened to your shadow self. They shouldn't have to pay every time you feel convicted or there's a problem in your life. Don't double down on your wrong choices and lean into your controlling ways. That's your shadow self. That's not who you are anymore. And so Abraham gets stressed. Ever seen that in the Bible? So many of us today say, I'm stressed. You know, people in the Bible got stressed too. Verse 11, the matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son, because he loves his son. But God said to him, do not be so distressed about the boy and your slave woman. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the slave into a nation also, because he is your offspring. And the last time Abraham wanted to get rid of them and dodge this whole situation and push them out, he suffered 13 years of silence from God. 13 years. But now, however, God is saying, it's time for the boys to separate. Isaac is my promised seed. Isaac is the one that I'm going to bless and the line that my promised people will continue through. However, I'm going to take care of Ishmael. I love Ishmael as well. And there's no doubt that Abraham loved his son as well. In fact, once we get to Genesis chapter 25, you're going to see that Ishmael does have 12 sons, and God makes a great nation out of him. But what God is saying is, listen, I have the ability, and I have the authority, and I have the knowledge to have plans that are bigger and deeper and more mind-blowing than you can even imagine. What I'm doing is something massive in this thing called the grand story, this grand narrative. And in my sovereignty, I pick who I want to pick, how I want to pick them. And I don't base my choosing on the criteria of man or how they respond to me. I will choose out of love, and I've made this decision. I will, though, take care of Ishmael. In verses 14 and 19, God will say, hey, by the way, while you guys are out there, it's going to feel terrible. It's going to feel like you're on death's door, but you're not. I see you, Hagar. I hear you, Ishmael. Remember, you're the first people that called me El Roy, the God who sees, who senses, who hears. And so don't forget that you, Hagar, are the first one to call me that, but it's time now for Ishmael to start a family and for these boys to part ways. And so we close out this section in verse 20 where it says, God was with the boy as he grew up. He lived in the desert and he became an archer. While he was living in the desert of Paran, his mother got a wife for him from Egypt. Of course she did. Moms always like to pick wives, don't they? I don't like that one. Same thing here. So he marries, and his legacy now begins as God takes care of this boy whom he loves, but who isn't the chosen seed of Abraham and ultimately of God. So here finally we see the promise made is the promise kept. And while it's been over 25 years, Abraham and Sarah's greatest desire has been fulfilled. That which they have longed for, that's what they waited for, that's what they've suffered through for their whole life. Their life now revolves around this one thing, this boy. All of their dreams, all of their expectations rest in God bringing about a chosen son, and it's finally arrived. And if there was ever an original hover parent, if there was ever helicopter parents ever, tell me it's not these two. Where are you going? Where are you going? Can I go with you? No, Mom. Leave me alone. You know they're just swarming around him, protecting him, loving him, making it all about them. And that's what makes what we're about to read in Genesis chapter 22 seem all the more absurd, all the more insane, given what Abraham and Sarah have been hoping for their entire lives. And on Mother's Day, I think especially our moms are gonna feel this one maybe a little differently. Because what's coming now just doesn't fit into any category that we have as parents. Genesis 22 verse 1 says, sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham! Exclamation point. So God is clearly speaking loud enough for him to hear. Exclamation point. Here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, so he's being very clear, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you. And like, I'm sorry, what? This story went south fast. God shows up and says to Abraham, I want you to take your son, your only son, this kid who you love, this son who your whole life has been invested in, your whole life you've been waited for, who you've waited for and waited for and waited for, and I want you to offer him as a burnt offering, as a sacrifice offering on the mountain range in Moriah that I will show you. And I thought, is it just me or does this sound nuts? I mean, some of you are like, oh yeah. This is nuts. Like, you know, this stuff gets you arrested, you know, all sorts of things in today's. And just so we know, most commentators right here believe that Isaac's 15. He's a sophomore in high school at this point. And God says, listen, I want you to take now these years that you've waited for him, 25 plus 15, 40 years, because you did 25 waiting for him. You did 15 raising him. You've enjoyed him. I want you to take your son, your only son. I want you to offer him on my behalf, as if to say to Abraham, there's no backup plan. There is no other son. The sons have separated now. This is the son. Ishmael has his own life now. And if you look at verse 1, it says that God is testing him. And one of the things we have to remember when it comes to a test of God is he is in control. It's never like God's up there going, well, let's just see what happens. Nobody knows. We're just gonna watch and see what happens. God is doing something here, and he's very much in control of this whole thing. This is not an accident. This is not some random thing. God is doing something in the life of our man Abraham. We also need to make sure we acknowledge that this is a test and not a temptation. Because God might test. Our God does not tempt. Don't confuse those two. James speaks to that in the New Testament clearly. He might put us in difficult situations or even allow difficult situations to play themselves out in his sovereign plan in our lives in order to do something in us, to accomplish something in us. But scripture is clear that he does not tempt anyone. God is doing something purposeful in Abraham to bring something out of him. He's actually going to refine him. Because tests also refine us. If you're familiar with the silversmithing process, what a silversmith does is he puts the silver in a crucible and he puts it over a flame. And then once it's over the flame, he turns up the heat. And as the heat increases, all the dross, all the impurities that are within that silver slowly begin to come to the top. The heat causes those impurities to rise to the top. And then very carefully, the skilled silversmith removes the impurities that have risen to the surface, purifying what remains. The heat is being turned up in Abraham's life. This is a refinement process. And it's said that a silversmith knows when he is finished removing those impurities, when he can look into that silver and he can see his image in it. And so is our God. God is doing something in Abraham's life here. This is what tests do, both to Abraham and to us. They refine us. But not only that, tests have this funny way of revealing what we treasure most. See, don't view this test like God is wondering what will happen. God knows what will happen. He's omniscient. He's all-knowing. He's not watching this with his, like a movie with popcorn going, wow, this is awesome. This is a nail-biter. Wonder what's going to happen. That's not what's happening here. So then the question is, why is God asking this? Because if God knows our future as accurately as he knows our past, then he doesn't test people to see how well their faith will respond under fire. He prepares tests of faith to show us what he has made of us lately. To show us what he's made of us lately. Whether we pass or fail, we learn about ourselves, we learn where we need improvement or just discover how spiritually mature we may have become. Abraham's life has been a journey of faith for 25 plus years. And there have been days that Abraham, we've seen him go, and he's just killed it. He's just awesome. And then we saw other days where he stumbled. But in this moment, what Abraham's going to see is, has your faith reached fruition? Has your faith? That's the question Abraham's asking. Sort of. Has your faith reached full maturation? And God is allowing Abraham the opportunity to see the answer to the question, am I your greatest treasure? God knows the answer to that. He wants Abraham to know the answer to that. Are you willing to set something aside that you dearly love? Do you trust me with that which you hold most dear? Will you set aside the thing that brings you the greatest joy, and will you trust me? And so I think it's worth us taking a second answering the question, what's your Isaac? What's your Isaac in your life? As you think about the story, if God said to you, I want you to lay this down, and I want you to put it on the altar for me, what's your Isaac? Who would it be? For some of you, it would be maybe a person. It would be your kids. No, God, you can't have them. That's just not doable. Some would be your spouse. For some of you, it would be your moms. Because in my house, things just happen magically, and I realize magic doesn't exist. It's my wife. Right? It all gets, it's her. I don't know what we do. For some, it could be a friend. It could be all sorts of people. But it's a person. Lord, if you took that person out of my life, I would absolutely be devastated. I love them so much, I can't let them go. For some of you, your Isaac would be a possession. The things that you've accumulated, maybe a house. You've waited your life for a car that means so much to you. Maybe for you it's money. Maybe for some of you it's the memento. Your house is burning down and you're running back in. You don't care if you die. You're getting that memento of your mom, of your dad, of your heritage. You'll risk your life for that. For some of you, it's your Isaac's control. Maybe it's your health. God, take anything from me. Just don't take my health. For some of you, it's your job. You'll say, I'll ruin my marriage. I'll give up my kids. I'll just don't take my job from me. Some of you might laugh at that, but some of you are living that right now. You'll give up everything for your job. Or maybe you're looking going, I think I have a lot of Isaacs. I have a lot of that stuff. What is it that you treasure most in this world? And then I would ask, if I ask your kids, what would they say your Isaac is? What if I ask your family or your friends, what would they say your Isaac is? What would be the thing that would devastate you, that God would have to just rip out of your hands and he'd have to say, trust me, will you let go of that and lean into me? And here in this story, this thing that Abraham has loved, this son that he's raised for the last 15 years, the son that he's painfully waited on for 25 years prior, God says, I want you to lay him on the altar. And look at Abraham's response in verse 3. Early the next morning, Abraham got up, loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. You know what astounds me about that is, where's the hesitation? Like, where is the waffling? Like, I'm looking for the section where Abraham responds, hey, God, what? I must have misheard you. I clearly misunderstood you. Because after all the journeys we've gone through, after all the kook slams that I've wrestled with, all of these things that have been showing itself in my life, after all the correction and face-to-face moments with the pre-incarnate Jesus, I look at Abraham and I go, he has such a different faith than I do. This is like next level faith, isn't it? Like, this is like college level faith. Me, I'm like, God, I think I'm gonna drop that class and pick it up next semester, right? I don't know that I'm gonna be able to finish this class. I don't think so. But not Abraham. He has learned that our God is greater than our Isaacs. Not sure I know that. That our God is greater than my marriage, than my kids, than my job, my house, or whatever. Our God is greater than all of them. He can be trusted with them all. He is greater. He is more powerful. He is worthy to be praised, and he is worthy to be obeyed above them all. And if you look at verse 4, it says, on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. And my question is, why are we skipping over the conversation that they had while they walked? Because I want to know what that conversation was like, right? Because they're walking for 3 days, going along, and what's Isaac thinking as he's walking? I think he's trying to figure out what's going on. He's like, what? Why are we going? This is sort of a sudden trip. This wasn't a planned vacation. Why are we going over there to sacrifice? This is all so odd. But at the same time, Abraham's walking along going, Lord, I trust you, but I don't get this completely. And I don't know why you're asking me to do this. I love you, and I will give you that which I hold most dear because you are my greatest treasure. But I don't know how this thing's going to finish. But I'm going to walk down this road. I wonder if Abraham's caught up in here. There's a lot of silence as they walk. I wonder if Isaac's going, Dad's awful quiet. Wish we knew more here. Because I thought, what a tense and confusing journey they're on. Verse 5, he said to his servant, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. So Abraham leaves these two dudes at the base of Mount Moriah. He and Isaac are now going to travel alone to the top of the mountain. But what's the key word there that's out of place? We. Because shouldn't it be, the boy and I are going to go over there, and I'll be back in a second. I mean, shouldn't that be really what it sounds like? Because that's what's going on. The we really should be me. The author of Hebrews helps us understand what's going on a little better, actually, in Abraham's mind. Hebrews 11 says, by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so, in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. The author of Hebrews says that in this moment, Abraham believed that it came to the point, if he had to actually kill his son, that God could raise him from the dead. And for me, I read that and I'm like, are you kidding me? Because here's the deal. In our world, if I were to tell you, have you ever heard of someone being raised from the dead? Most Christians go, well, yeah, like Lazarus, you know, Jesus, like we've heard of that. Up to this point, how many people in the book of Genesis have we heard at all who've been raised from the dead? Zero. Like that's not a thing. There's been no teachings that people raised from the dead. So how do you get to the point where you're going, I don't know, I guess he's just gonna come back to life? Like that's a huge leap. Abraham has never seen God do anything like that, ever. But he says, Lord, I don't get this, but I trust you that you're so big, that you're so sovereign, that you're so powerful, you're so good and so great, that if this happens, I bet you can raise him from the dead. That's amazing to me. In verse 6, it says, Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac. So now Isaac's carrying the wood. And he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up, probably mumbled, and said to his father, Abraham, father? Yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? I thought, that's a fair question, right? You know, hey, dad, we've done this before. Like, we've done this whole wood and fire and killing an animal and sacrifice. So that's not new to me, God, but, you know, I know what's required. We need wood, and we need fire, and we need a knife, but you need a lamb. I see everything else but the lamb. And so where's the lamb for the burnt offering? I wonder if the 15-year-old's starting to go, mayday, like I don't know if a bulb's going off yet, but I wonder if he's starting to put some things together. Verse 8, Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. And right here, I think it feels like time begins to slow down. Verse 9, when they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Can you imagine what it would be like to say to your 15-year-old son, I'm going to need to bind your hands right now. And I promised you that God would provide a lamb. And he will. But I'm gonna need to lay you down this altar. I'm gonna need you to trust me. I remember early on when my daughter was about 6, she was on some swings, fell off that swing, hit the gravel ground, huge piece of skin on her knee just flipped back. She came to me crying, I picked her up, and you look at it and you're like, oh, that's an ER visit. We headed to the ER, and we got there, and the doctor's like, yeah, stitches for sure. She's definitely going to need stitches. And so what they do next, young or old, is they come at you with a needle. And they're going to take that needle, and they're going to stick it in the wound in order to numb it. And then they're going to take a toothbrush, and they're going to flood it. Some of you are already squeamish right now. I can hear you. You know, and they're going to scrub it out with a tube, because they're going to get all the gravel and all the dirt out of there before they stitch it back up. Otherwise, you're going to get an infection. So here's these people coming at us with this needle. And I'm looking at my daughter going, trust me. And she's going, why, Daddy? Why are you letting them do this to me? Daddy, what's happening? This doesn't seem right at all. And I just kept saying, trust me, sweetheart, trust me. It's okay. Hold still. But it hurts, Daddy. I'm like, I know it hurts. You know, but it'll be okay. Trust me. She just couldn't understand what was happening. And I thought, that moment pales in comparison to what must be happening in this moment between Abraham and his son, his only son, the son whom he loved. And Abraham is trusting God, knowing that if he does this, there is no plan B. And I trust that my God is big enough, that he is powerful enough, and that he is all-knowing enough that he will bring him back, even back from the dead. But I don't want to do this. And did you notice in the story, there's no struggle from Isaac. You know, he's 15, dad's 125. He can outrun him. I mean, probably overpower him. I'm just thinking, it doesn't feel like my dad and I used to play Mercy as kids. 125, I just snap dad's hand. Like, it seems like he could get away, but he doesn't. He's willing. In this moment, he lays his life down and says, Dad, I trust you. There just seems to be this quiet obedience to the Father. And in verse 10, it's really the climax of the whole story. It says, then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. And while we do have a God who tests, never forget, we also have a God who saves. A God who steps in at the exact right time. But you read that and you thought, God now knows something? That's a weird language. Like God was unsure before? No, well, this is what's called anthropomorphic language. And that language in the original text means that physical human attributes are ascribed to God to help us understand. That's what anthropomorphic language is. And so what he's saying is, I need you to see that your faith has reached a very important milestone. Not that I need to know. You need to know that your faith is there. It's reached a very, very important place. And you're like, you fear God. And you're like, well, it's not that he's afraid of God. It means that you are fully trusting in, you are fully submitted to, that you are in awe of God. He is your greatest treasure, trusting him with the most important things. And in verse 13, Abraham, it says, Abraham looked up. And there in the thicket, he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, the Lord will provide, Jehovah Jireh. And to this day, it is said, on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. God was very much in this moment, and now he provides a substitute. And so instead of this moment breaking Abraham, it now brings him to the summit of his life. And many of you know, or at least you can remember a time, or maybe this is you right now, that God, it feels like, is turning up the heat in your life. It feels like it's getting hotter and hotter in your life. In an effort to remove some impurities and to see his image more clearly in you. And while that's a difficult place to be, that's a scary place to be, to lean in and say, Lord, I trust you. I'm going to walk through this season of difficulty. I'm going to trust you with this issue, with my kids, with my marriage, with this time in my life. God, this just seems crazy to me, but I trust you. And I know that you love me. But you realize that's only one way to respond. To lean in and say, God, I'm gonna trust you when the heat gets turned up. Because there is another way. There's another response. Jeremiah chapter 6 says, the bellows blow fiercely to burn away the lead with fire. But the refining goes on in vain. The wicked are not purged out. You're like, what does that mean? Jeremiah was a prophet, not a bullfrog, right? And so he's a prophet of Israel. That's a terrible dad joke, whatever. I think it's funny. He's a prophet of Israel during a very, very dark time in Israel. All these people are worshiping false gods. They're worshiping all of these idols. And all these people, the people of God, are living in disobedience. And what Jeremiah says is, you have refused to be refined. You refuse to allow God to lovingly and graciously turn up the heat in your life to remove that dross, to remove those impurities, to make you more like him. You refuse. You refuse that. And instead of refusing that, only you now embrace the dross. You embrace the impurities. You did not walk with God in that moment. So there is another response that sometimes you can have or others can have, but Abraham does not choose that road because the shadow self is slowly becoming his past. And so what you're going to see is God reaffirms this covenant in verses 15 to 18. The covenant they gave him 40 years earlier of land, seed, and blessing. I'm gonna give you these things. And in verse 20 to 24, there's a little short genealogy, the story of a woman by the name of Rebecca who will be Abraham and Sarah's future daughter-in-law, the future wife of Isaac. And we're gonna talk about that next week. And as we look at this story, there's some things that I think are important for you to see here. This promise is an image of a much greater story, of a much greater promise. In fact, the whole thing revolves around one question, and the question is, where is the Lamb? If someone were to ask me to summarize the entire Old Testament, that's my answer in one word or one phrase. Where is the Lamb that we have been waiting for? Because really, this story, if you haven't figured out, should sound really, really familiar. A father who takes his son, his only son, whom he loves, to offer his son as a sacrifice. Another son like Isaac, who carried wood on his back for a sacrifice. Another son like Isaac who would be the sacrificial lamb, and another father like Abraham who believes his son could return from the dead. But unlike Isaac, no ram was provided as the substitute for this son. And though the father certainly grieved that his son would have to die, there was no sinless alternative. There was no substitute for the substitute. And the son cries out in the garden, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me, but not my will be done, yours." No struggle. And like Isaac, he willingly laid down his life, trusting his father. And just as Abraham could trust his heavenly father to provide, I need you to know this morning that you can too. Because God has provided a sinless, perfect, final substitute for you, the Lamb of God, Jesus Christ. Church, this story is to remind you of a bigger story, a far more important story in the grand scheme of history. Do you realize that this whole story takes place 2,000 years in the same location that the story of Jesus is gonna take place? It's the same place. 2,000 years after Abraham and Isaac, that God would sacrifice his son, his one and only son, whom he loves, sacrificing him on our behalf. And I would like to end this message on Mother's Day asking you the question, do you know the Lamb? Do you know the Son? Do you know him as trustworthy? Do you know him as your provider? Do you know Jehovah Jireh? Do you know him? Do you know him as the God who sees you, as the God who hears you? Do you know him as El Roy? Do you know him as your deliverer? Do you know him as your healer? Do you know our Lamb? Do you know the Lamb who saves you? Do you know the Lamb who sanctifies you? Do you know the Lamb who heals you and the Lamb who is coming again? Why? Because, church, this is the gospel according to Genesis.